Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to this event at Wolfson College. My name is Dennis Galligan, Professor of Sociolegal Studies and a Fellow of the College. It's a very, very great privilege to welcome our four panelists, whom I'll introduce in a moment, and to welcome a very good-sized audience for a fairly unpleasant night like this evening. So we hope that you will find having come here well worthwhile, with four lively presentations followed by some discussion. So we start now, we finish at 7. Each of the speakers will have 15 minutes, leaving a reasonable amount of time for discussion. And then there'll be drinks in the foyer at the end. So we hope that you'll join us for that. Well, this event is sponsored by three institutions. First of all, the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which is an independent charitable institution affiliated with the university, but independent. And the foundation was created in 2005 with our chairman, Mr. John Adams, who is here tonight, happily. Welcome, John. And the idea of the foundation was to try to make academic research in the social science, with particular reference to law in society, to make that research more accessible to the non-specialist, the non-academic reader. Professional groups, government bodies, non-governmental bodies, and so on. And in that period, if you go to our website, you will see that we've had a number of programs which have, I think, brought together the two constituencies quite nicely. And if you go to the website, you'll see a wealth of interesting policy briefs and podcasts and all sorts of other things about the activities we've conducted since 2005. The second institution is the Centre for Sociolegal Studies, which is a research institute within the university. The Centre for Sociolegal Studies is an old and well-established institute dedicated to the study of law and society. And both Bettina Langer and myself are members of that institute. The third institution is, of course, Wolfson College, where we are in this very nice, very attractive, relatively new auditorium, opened just in the summer of last year, and very suitable for these occasions. So Wolfson College has entered into a collaboration with those other two institutions I mentioned to try to create what we call research clusters within the college. Research clusters in the sense that we know people are mainly doing their research in their departments, etc. But on the other hand, in a postgraduate college where there is no other obvious reason in a way for the college other than a very pleasant environment, the idea of research clusters is to give some focus and some opportunities for people with very different interests nevertheless coming together on occasions such as this. And so I think it's added immensely to the interest of the college. This is the Law, Justice and Society cluster, so it's a pretty broad brief, and I hope that tonight's discussion will touch on at least law, justice and society in some ways. Well, now I should just turn to introduce our four speakers who will contribute to a different perspective to this book we're under discussion tonight, The New Global Readers, which I'm sure you're all familiar with and read carefully. So first of all, let me just introduce our speakers very briefly. We'll start off with Dr. Bettina Langer, who is a member of the Law Faculty and the Centre for Sociolegal Studies, a lecturer in regulation, law and regulation, and a fellow of Wolfson College. Bettina has written extensively and conducted a wide range of research in various areas of regulation and currently working in areas of water and the environment. Bettina will be followed by Max Watson, again a well-known figure around Oxford since he retired from his more worldly pursuits to join us here. Max is a fellow of the college. He's also a member of the board of the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society. He directs a program on political economy of financial markets at the European Studies Centre of St. Anthony's College, and he has done many other things. I should just mention I attribute the success of the Irish economy to Max's involvement, since he was one of the directors of the Irish Central Bank, and I think was very instrumental in that success story. Our third speaker and third will be Amir Paz Fuchs, here on my right. Amir is a lecturer in employment law at Sussex Law School and an associate fellow of the Centre for Social Legal Studies. Amir did his doctorate here in Oxford in areas of employment, then returned to Israel for some years, and has just recently brought himself back to Oxford and now Sussex. So our final speaker then is Frank Wiebert on my far right. Frank is currently senior visiting fellow at the Department of Government of the LSE. He's also the founder and director of the European Policy Forum, which you will all have heard of, a well-known London think tank. Frank has also been a senior advisor on the World Bank, and again, like our other speakers, has many other achievements which I won't try to completely account for. So, we have, therefore, without more ado, let's start. Bettina, over to you.
Thank you. Tim Wüthis and Walter Matthies, the new global rulers. Privatization of regulation in the world economy is, in my view, an important book which makes a major contribution to debates about the regulation of business actors. The book captures an increasingly salient phenomenon, which is that governments within the confines of the nation state are no longer central to the setting of standards for business activity. Instead, private standardization organizations in the transnational sphere are increasingly the standard setters, the new global rulers. The book explores this growing trend for regulation within two specific empirical contexts. First, accounting standards, that is, standards that regulate how to calculate assets, liabilities, profits, and losses of companies. And second, product standards, the standards that shape the technical specifications of design and performance of manufactured goods, such as standards for electrical household appliances. At first glance, it may appear that the subject matter of the book is rather dry. The book examines the intricacies of the work of slightly obscure organizations, often just known through their acronyms, such as ISO, the International Standard Organization, IASB, the International Accounting Standards Board, and IEC, the International Electrotechnical Commission. But these organizations matter. The ISO and IEC jointly set about 85% of all international product standards. But at the heart of the book is an intensely political analysis of what would be a mistake to perceive as simply the dry matter of international private standard setting. What motivates the inquiry in the book is an interest in who gains and who loses from the increasing privatization of international standard setting. So in the contribution to the roundtable, I will, in the first part, set out in a little bit more detail Tim Wüthis and Walter Matthies' argument and how they developed that argument. And the second part, I will provide a critique of some of their points. And the third part, I will highlight the contribution of the book to wider public policy debates. So what is it that they're arguing? Well, Wüthis and Matthies suggest that product and financial markets are increasingly governed through the standard-setting activities of private actors in the transnational sphere. In order to make this argument, they focus in particular on one particular aspect: the delegation of regulatory authority from governance to a single international private sector body that is viewed by both public and private actors as the obvious and thus not contested forum for global regulation. While this delegation to the transnational sphere is important, Wüthis and Matthies emphasize that domestic private sector standard setters remain crucial for international standard setting. Domestic private standard setters lobby international standard setting organizations in order to defend the regulatory preferences of national economic sectors and also to minimize the risk and often significant cost of switching to a new set of standards. According to Wüthis and Matthies, and not surprisingly, timely information and effective representation of domestic interests are particularly important for determining who loses and who wins in the process of setting international standards. And Wüthis and Matthies argue that firms that operate in a hierarchical and coordinated domestic system are likely to have greater influence in international negotiations because such a domestic system fits more naturally with an organizational structure in the transnational sphere that centers on what they call a single focal organization. This point is an important plank of what Büthe and Mattley call the theory of institutional complementarity, which they develop in the book. This theory suggests that the greater the degree of institutional complementarity between the domestic and global levels, the more likely it is that the domestic actors will be able to shape the international standards. This then means that the firms who operate in a fragmented domestic system that is characterized by contestation among rival standard setters are less likely to be influential in international standard setting. Büthe and Mattley consider the specific shift of standard setting authority from governments to international focal institutions to be part of a wider picture of transfer of regulatory authority to the international sphere. And so in chapter 2 of their book, they develop a new typology of institutional settings for rulemaking that consists of four types of shifts of standard setting to the international sphere. And since it's an important part, really, that they make to scholarship in the area, I thought it would be nice to display kind of the colored slide that captures what they're doing in chapter 2. So it's the diagram they themselves have in that chapter. And so what they set out there is they recognize two key dimensions that they focus on in order to characterize the different ways in which regulatory standard setting is shifting. So the idea of the market as a standard, so the two dimensions are non-market based and market based, as one can see on the left-hand side. And the idea of market-based standard setting means that there's a market as a standard setting body, that the standard is set not by virtue of the authority of a specific standard setting organization, may it be national or international, but the selection of standards occurs through the mechanism of competition between various public or private standard setters. Büthe and Mattley distinguish this form of market-based standard setting from non-market-based standard setting, which is what they involves what they call focal institutions. And here the selection of a standard is not the outcome of competition for standards and markets, but standards are set by virtue of the authority of an international agreement, an international organization, or a transgovernmental regulatory collaboration. And an example, for example, for international standard setting through the international agreement is the Kyoto Protocol, which various nation state governments agree to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And the second key dimension according to which they distinguish different types of shift of standard setting is the distinction between public and private actors that one can see on the top horizontal line. So what they actually focus on mostly in the book in their discussion is in the work of transnational focal standard setting bodies, i.e. what's referred to in the box with number 4, kind of on the right hand, on the right hand top corner there. And examples of institutions for the right hand top corner area are institutions such as the International Electrotechnical Commission and the International Accounting Standards Board. And Büthe and Mattley's argument is grounded in substantive empirical analysis. They rely on both quantitative analysis based on two multi-country, multi-industry business services surveys. One of them is about international accounting standards and the other about international product standards. And the countries examined are the US and three large European countries, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom. And so the main conclusion that they reach is, on the basis of their empirical analysis, that the US has an advantage over European countries in influencing standards for financial accounting. And in contrast to this, in relation to product standards, European firms have an advantage over US firms in influencing standards in the transnational sphere. So to come on to some points of critique of their analysis, I first of all want to refer really to their methodology. The central concern of Tim Büthe's and Walter Mattley's work in this book are the distributive implications of the shifting of standard setting to an international sphere. But their research design seems to be limited for exploring the central interest. By focusing exclusively on states from the developed northern hemisphere, such as the US, France, UK, and Germany, the most sharply raised distributive questions are not addressed. Does Büthe's and Mattley's finding that the degree of complementarity between the domestic and international standard setting bodies determines influence in international standard setting also apply to developing countries? It's important to raise this question because there are significant costs for developing countries to be takers of international standards, because switching to these standards may impose particular opportunity costs or even prohibit access to northern markets for producers in developing countries. Moreover, Bütte's and Matley's concern with the distributional consequences of international standard setting does not take into account the differential opportunities for larger companies to influence international standard setting in comparison to small and medium-sized companies in a very explicit way. The second point of critique that came into my mind in reading the book is as well seeing that some aspects of their argument as well chime with things we know as well from inquiries in other fields. For instance, Tim Bütte and Walter Matley emphasize that international standardization is sometimes perceived and presented also by the standard organizations themselves as an apolitical, scientific process of identifying the technically optimal solution to a regulatory or technical challenge. In contrast to this, they argue it's important to recognize that international product standard setting is an intensely political rather than technocratic process. But it's a point that's also well known from studies, empirical studies, including in the field of national and international environmental standard setting, which has often implications also for product standards. And it also seems to me that the point about the politicization of international standard setting could be further taken to be not just the distribution of the interests and power play of the actors that Bütte and Matley describe in their book, but also new forms of politicization of standard setting. I think we're seeing in more recent initiatives, for example, for green product standards, where the politicization comes not just from the power play interest game, but comes from attempts to have explicit commitments to the pursuit of fundamental political values of how society should be organized, i.e. how much we go towards combating climate change, how we try to influence green consumer behavior, and so forth. And it's a form of politicization of product standards that is sort of not discussed here. Then thirdly, in their final chapter 8, Tim Bütte and Walter Matley refer to an impressive range of debates in the four key fields of political science, sociology, law, and economics to which they see their work contributing. This also further illustrates the wide significance of their theory of institutional complementarity for explaining patterns of influence in international standardization. But I think more could be said with reference to some of the debates they touch upon. For instance, in linking their work to legal scholarship, they focus on two issues. First, that law provides the opportunity to convert private standards into formal, legally binding provisions. And second, they raise the issue whether there's a role for law to impose rules of procedure for international standard setting. But this begs a question that is really important from a social-legal perspective. Do the standards really matter? There's a rich seam of social-legal research that has shown how accounting rules in a national context, when they are finally applied by private accountants and domestic authorities, can be gamed. That is, the accounting standards are circumvented through sophisticated legal advice on creative compliance. For instance, in a recent paper entitled Financial Engineering or Legal Engineering, Doreen McBarnett argues that legal creative work removed the obstacles of accounting requirements and that this also contributed to the recent financial crisis. And one example of this creative compliance games are special purpose vehicles. These are entities that feature centrally in securitizations. Separate companies or other legal forms are created so that they are technically and legally distinct from the originating company. The special purpose vehicle has been widely used in corporate creative accounting as a technique for consciously circumventing company law obligations to disclose a true and fair view of corporate finances to shareholders. It has been used to keep debts or liabilities out of their accounts, enhancing apparent performance and misleading the market. If one follows this social legal work, then a theory that explains patterns of influence and private international standard making may not provide a complete picture of who wins and who loses. If it is possible to circumvent international accounting standards in domestic context, new patterns of winners and losers may arise, and such new patterns may provide an important correction to who is considered as winning or losing in the transnational sphere. The last point, just to as well think a little bit about implications for wider debates, since my final point. I think the book makes a welcome contribution to a wide range of debates, not least the currently revived debate about whether the UK wants to continue to be a member of the European Union. And the book perhaps may be considered as providing social science evidence for an economic case for the UK to remain in the EU. The book finds that the EU has greater influence than the US on the setting of international product standards because EU firms operate in a hierarchical and coordinated system which has greater complementarity with international standard setting bodies and hence provides greater influence as well for specific UK firms in the transnational standard setting sphere. And I think that's all that I want to start off with.
Well, thank you very much, Bettina. So we'll keep the discussion until we've heard all of the speakers. In that case, we'll go straight to you, Max.
Thank you, Dennis. Thanks very much for inviting me. I'm going to sort of pick up, I think, where Bettina left off, more or less, and try to put this in a slightly broader context as she was at the end. I mean, this phenomenon they pick on in the book is part of a wider and quite long-standing trend towards expert governance, towards what's sometimes called soft governance, towards governance by the private sector and self-regulation. And I'm thinking of titles like Frank's book, The Rise of the Unelected, which was about mainly official experts doing governance. But I'm also thinking a long time ago of Lou Powley in Toronto, the dean of the political economy faculty there, who wrote a book called Who Elected the Bankers? And here you could say, who elected the standard setters? Who elected the accountants? But also, if you think back to the literature on regulatory capture of regulators, that one of the surveys done in the late 80s discovered that the civil aviation regulation in the States had been written by the airlines. They were asked to write the regulation for themselves. So that this is not a completely new phenomenon. Now, and there are analogies in other areas, as Bettina was saying, in the areas that like environment, but in the economic area, if you think of the role of the G20 in international governance, that's supposed to be a soft governance body that cuts through the complications. This is one of the points that Bhutta and Matley make, the complications and complexities, the rigidities of formal bodies like the IMF. If you think of the role of self-regulation in the financial sector, that has come and gone. Self-regulatory bodies were very fashionable in the UK in the 70s, and then they were found to need legal backup powers. But later, the financial sector moved to incorporate, in the last decade, huge amounts of private standard setting through rating agencies and other bodies. And I'll come back to the implications of that. But this the phenomenon that Bhutta and Matley describe really adds a new twist, because here the industry doesn't just capture people, the industry becomes the regulator. So this is the what you might call the apotheosis of the private sector as a regulator. And I think it raises a range of questions. I'm going to focus on three. They don't overlap. Well, one of them overlaps with Bettina. I hope there won't be too much duplication in our comments. The first question is, why are governments doing this? Why are they delegating? Now, Bhutta and Matley do discuss that briefly, and they say rather briskly it's due to a lack of public expertise, a lack of public money, and a lack of public flexibility. And I buy all of that. But I think, and I'm thinking here, Dennis and Frank and Amir, of the workshop we had on regulatory capture back some months ago, I think one has to see this also against an ideological climate of saying, well, really the private sector knows best, that it is best on the whole to insert the private sector as far as possible in regulation. And that was inspired in part by an ideology that was suspicious of government, and that thought that issues like public choice, the self-interested action of government agents, myopia in government, that these weaknesses of government needed to be addressed by different approaches to regulation. Now, there is a lesson, I think, in what drove governments to delegate. The financial crisis illustrates how you can mess up in this regard. They incorporated large swathes of official of private sector standards, ways of calculating risk, value at risk methods, using private sector rating agencies instead of official standards of country rating. And the result, we know, was it contributed majorly to the disaster. So we need to question, I think, whether what drives governments to delegate to the private sector can at times be naive. Now, the second question is, what about effectiveness? And again, Buta and Matley kind of touch on this, but they tend to move on. I think there's a widespread perception, if you go back over the last couple of decades, that the international accounting standards bodies have not been very effective. They have not taken decisions quickly, they have not been forward-looking, they have spent endless years at times in deliberating on standards. Not a very, very effective body. And if you think in another realm of the G20, with all its informality and flexibility, most people would say it hasn't proved an effective body, that moving to these forms of soft and private sector governance, respectively, may not be effective in terms of decision-making and rule-setting. And then there's enforcement. What about effectiveness in terms of enforcement? And then Buta Matley rightly say, well, the IFIs and governments come in and essentially have to enforce the private sector standards. So the WTO implicitly enforces product standards because it says you have to do these unless there's an overwhelming reason, I think they say, why the international standards are not applicable in your case. And we saw that in the City of London, where eventually all the informal bodies like the Takeover Panel had to be backed up with legal powers to deal with abuse in the city. I think, therefore, the effectiveness of these procedures ultimately also depends on government. So we can't kind of move government out of the picture completely. Now that brings me, thirdly, and I'm going, and Dennis is going to gasp as I say these words, the public interest. And we had long debates in a paper I was writing about these words, the public interest, which are very tricky. Mitnick said, the concept of the public interest is, of course, the most notorious and the most cautioned against, in his famous book on the political economy of regulation. That was 33 years ago. And I think when I wrote that paper, actually Dennis's advice to me really was, get Microsoft Word, do a search and replace. Every time you find the words public interest in your paper, switch in what you're actually worried about. Is it the ceiling will fall in, the doors are weak? What is the public interest? It's a vague phrase. So let me narrow in immediately and say what I mean by the public interest, because I think this is a considerable issue. Bettino, I think, was raising this question of other external interests in what she was saying. And the concern being that the private sector will conspire to produce regulation that ultimately is not in favour of the public interest. What are the concerns there? I think there are quite a few. Three especially, anti-competitive behaviour, that the private sector may come to arrangements where they, and this was the airline industry regulation in the States, it looked absolutely superb, it was technically fine, it looked absolutely impeccable, but it prevented anybody new from entering the industry for a very long time. The second, and Bettina mentioned this very directly, is externalities. In the environment, I think it's easy to sort of feel and show what the externalities are, they're kind of green and out there. But they're also, think of accountant standard setting, if you have to, and think about the idea of marking things to market, marking them very quickly to the market value. That has very big externalities as regards financial stability, because banks' balance sheets go up and down with the market. Now, this may be good, it may be bad, it depends how American you are. I'm kind of mid-Atlantic myself. But this issue of externalities, we can't assume that private regulators will internalize them. And I think the other one, and here Buta and Matley do go into it, is the interest of the consumer, which is not identical with the public interest. It's an element in the public interest, consumer safety and so forth. And they do address that straight on and say the arrangements that have been made for that are, I think they essentially say they're hollow, that the public sector needs to ensure that the consumer has an effective voice. Now I want to, so I've just sounded as if I really would never let the private sector do anything, but I want now, having, and I hold by all those three worries, I want to turn this on its head for a moment and say, but are there some rather good things that the private sector could be doing? Are there countervailing gains from this kind of private sector regulation? And I think there are. And one is indeed that it does help insulate regulation from political influences of a nefarious kind. So it takes things out of the political domain. When we do that normally by delegation, we think of things like a monetary policy committee, but you give them a very narrow remit. You say, you look at inflation and nothing else, and then the government's happy to delegate a function to you. And in this case, you delegate the function, but you don't have that lack of periphery of vision. The private sector can look at all of the issues it wants to. It can be flexible. It can evolve. And so there is a question of removing it. In most of my experience of regulation has been many of the problems are actually caused by the public sector and its indirect pursuit of goals, not by the private sector. That's a plus. I do think, and it came out of our discussions, Dennis, including with Chris Decker, that in industries today there is a lot of gaming and recourse to complexity in order to capture the regulators and fox them. And that's true in the financial sector with all its complex equations, but it's also true in things like utilities regulation, where people load profit onto non-regulated gas products and so forth. So there's gaming, there's arbitrage. But as Bettina was hinting, can we be sure that hasn't just been internalized by the private sector, that they are creating regulations which are built to be gamed? I think that needs the tires to be kicked. It's quite possible that the private sector would create regimes which, as Bettina said, can be implemented in ways that don't bind it. But then I was fascinated when I read the book. There's an interesting thought here. Why is it, say, that the United States is not really good at punching its weight in product regulation, and Europe in accounting regulation? And the answer given, I think, is that the industry is fragmented, not hierarchical, and that there are strong vested interests. And even though you have many Americans sitting in rooms thinking we really ought to get together and do public product regulation, we should nail the Europeans, we must get together, they don't, because the vested interests, often anti-competitive interests, are so strong they're inhibited from organizing themselves. But maybe then, if you're a Darwinian, you could say, but look, in international regulation, the people who are effective are those where there aren't strong vested interests that hijack national regulation. Perhaps you can make an argument that it is the more democratic systems that produce this hierarchical form of regulation, and that where there are very strong, two or three very strong companies dominating an industry, they will prevent that happening. It's at least a thought that comes out of Walter and Matley, out of Walter Matley and Tim Buter. It seems to me when I look at the pros and cons of all that, it seems to me the message I would have is you do need a very strong public sector oversight of that, and it's particularly true in enforcement. It's true in terms of externalities, and I suspect it is also true in these areas of complexity and gaming. And I think the critique of, in that sense, the book's critique of the public interest, which really is limited to consumer safety kind of issues, this is much too narrow a way of looking at it. Let me just end by asking a kind of question which is in my mind, and it's a question of how to frame this debate. If you look at the sort of literature on soft governance, the way it's framed, the trade-offs tend to be, and you can find it here in Buter and Matley, well, you use soft governance when things need flexibility, they need informality, they evolve rapidly, they're complex. So you trade off the need for soft governance, expert governance, private governance along that dimension. But what I've just been suggesting, I think, suggests a different way of framing it, which is the trade-offs are more a concern about where political influence may be really damaging, where you need to take things out of the public domain to some extent, whether delegating it to an official body means being so narrow that you end up with a myopic approach to the topic, and how you think these issues of complexity and gaming are working out. In other words, I think you need to frame the issue in terms of this interaction between the public and private sector in regulation, and I can't resist ending with the words that involves looking at officials and private sector people Operating Within a Regulatory Space, which is the title of Frank's next book, so I'm giving him advance publicity for this. And on that, I know at least I've got one voter for me in the audience. I'm going to end, Frank.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Max. So our third speaker is Javier.
I think that's a better mic. Oh, is this working? Yeah, it's fine. So it's very difficult to speak after Bettina and Max. I think we should compare notes and before we do that, because I think quite a few of my thoughts overlap to some extent, but for the benefit of the two or three people in the audience and haven't read the book, perhaps it will be worthwhile pointing them out. So for myself, I have mixed feelings about the book. And in the same vein as Bettina and Max, I'm very glad I had the opportunity to read it thoroughly. And I think those of you who haven't had the opportunity should. It won quite a few prizes, but perhaps not for the reasons that the authors suggest. On the one hand, the main argument presented in the book seems relatively obvious, as I'll try to explain. On the other hand, some seemingly peripheral and perhaps even minor points that are not addressed directly or elaborated on strike me as very interesting and merit further inquiry. And with this, I'll pretty much follow in the same vein as Bettina and Max. So as you heard, the book makes a very powerful, yet what I think very simple claim. It hypothesizes, then proves empirically, that the ability to initiate, change, influence, or stall regulations on the global stage depends on the character of domestic regulation. It does this by, the authors test the hypothesis through two case studies, financial markets and global markets for products, and the results seem very persuasive. So I'll just point out a few details. I think they're quite interesting. So in the financial market, the IASB, the International Accounting Standards Board, in less than two decades of operation managed to solidify its status as the international financial regulator. The EU passed legislation in 2002 requiring all firms listed on a stock exchange in the EU to use its standards, the IFRS, and this was followed by similar decisions in small countries such as China, Japan, Brazil, India, Canada, and South Korea. And by 2008, more than 100 countries were using IFRS. Now, the question that they ask is, to what extent do countries have an impact on the content of IFRS? And assuming that impact differs, why is this so? And so for an answer, the authors suggest that we turn our attention to the different institutional makeup. The US domestic regulatory structure is very hierarchical to the extent that the dominant regulatory institution, the FASB, is the de facto uncontested regulator of American accountancy practices. In contrast, European accountancy regulation is very fragmented with domestic institutions within countries, say in the UK there are six of them, and across countries compete for impact and domination. The result, as the authors show, is that when compared to their American counterparts, European firms have significantly less ability to propose regulation that will be advantageous to their interests or stall regulations that they find problematic. Now, before you jump to the conclusion that this is yet another story of American dominance on the global scene, as I did at this stage of reading the book, the authors offer a second case study. The global product markets present a mirror image of the one described above. The relatively familiar ISO draft standards for products that include, among others, fiber optics, chemical technology, construction materials, nuclear and solar energy, ergonomics, air and quality control, information technology, healthcare, e-commerce, and most famously, quality management. Here it is the European regulatory structure that is far more hierarchical. Each country in Europe has one national standards institute, BSI in Britain, DIN Germany, Spain, Sweden have the same. In contrast, the American framework is much more fragmented or decentralized. It comprises of 300 trade associations, 130 professional and scientific societies, 40 general membership organizations, and 150 consortia, which together have set more than 50,000 standards. The result, as you may have guessed by now, is that European firms have been much more successful at having an impact at a global level with ISO. For example, they tell the story of a European toy manufacturer developing international standards for safety and having them accepted verbatim by ISO. In contrast, American toy manufacturers learned of the new rules only after they've been adopted. That's the story. See, I told you it's simple. And a persuasive one. But at this stage, I would like to make what is perhaps a small objection to the author's repeated emphasis on compatibility between domestic and international standards, hierarchical structures. For what the authors show on their own terms is that domestic hierarchical institutions have more impact on the global stage, which is also structurally hierarchical, when compared with domestic regulators, which are much more fragmented. Their conclusion, therefore, is that the explanatory force lies in hierarchical meets hierarchical, and that it is much better than hierarchical meets fragmented. In contrast, I would like to suggest that, at least on the evidence they offer, a slightly different explanation is possible. Hierarchical domestic organizations are better placed to have an impact on the global stage than fragmented ones. It's not a matter of complementarity at all. This makes the argument even more simple and even intuitive, though I have very, 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 I can't stress this enough, little experience with global financial regulation. I do have my share of experience working with NGOs that seek to lobby policymakers and legislators on issues pertaining to social and economic rights in general, and labor rights in particular. And guess what? When coalitions are formed, a campaign is produced, a spokesperson is for the coalition or campaign is appointed, and strategy plans are devised and followed, they are much more effective than when each NGO tries to advance its own agenda, which shares some traits with the common goals, but differs dramatically and even opposes under other agendas, local workers versus migrant, young unemployed versus elderly, etc. So no huge surprises there. So now I can turn to the issues that to me were of interest and that I would have liked to see more discussion on. Since time is limited, I will name only two such issues. The first matter concerns the attitude of actors who are subject to regulation. Tired as I am, and I say this with trepidation, from hearing businesses' knee-jerk objection to any form of regulation, it was refreshing and even surprising to note a much more subtle attitude that was revealed in the survey that the authors composed. It turns out that when they have an effect on it, actors, even in hyper-capitalist sectors such as global finance, but also producers of medical products or toys, are very much aware of the benefits of regulation. They value the certainty that enables strategic planning, the harmonization that allows them to expand to new markets without the burden of adapting and reconfiguring their practices or products, and are quite aware, as Bettina mentioned, of the advantage of being on the right side of regulation and benefiting from less competition from those who do not comply with the regulation. The second matter, and this, I have very little to add to Max's point, but I'll do so anyway. The second matter is far more crucial and fundamental. It concerns a fact that I have neglected to mention to this point. These aforementioned global regulators, IASB and ISO, are private consortium. To be fair to the authors, this is not a matter that is neglected per se in the book. In fact, the book's full heading is The New Global Rulers, the Privatization of Regulation in the World Economy. And in the opening chapters, as Bettina mentioned, the authors offered a typology of institutional forms of global regulation and explain that their focus of inquiry is non-market, non-competitive, but non-state, i.e. private regulators. These consortiums are not only dominated by global firms in their respective sectors, but even on the occasion when governments wish to have some say, the governments are viewed as getting in the way of market consolidation, advancing their own partisan political agenda, as Max mentioned. Moreover, governments themselves have moved from ex-post acceptance of standards set by private regulators to ex-ante delegation of regulatory authority, a phenomenon which has been termed in 2009 article as unprecedented privatization of mandatory standard setting. And if we're aware of privatization that has occurred, that's quite a high calling to have an unprecedented privatization in 2009. ISO, as Bettina mentioned, on its own is responsible for over 85% of international standards that are set by private bodies. Against this background, it is indeed striking that these institutions, the way they operate, are the least studied among students and scholars of regulation. So as I mentioned, the fact that the book addresses these institutions implies that their very character as private institutions is very much in the background of the analysis. However, to my mind, it's a bit too much in the background. When the authors note very descriptively that governments are excluded from the process of standard setting, the necessary result is that the language and interests of markets and global capital dominates. Now, if this is done, as Max implied, because government officials operate at the behest of domestic business or for nefarious motivations that contribute to their political campaign, that is one thing. But if these officials seek to represent millions of stakeholders who are not sitting in the room, that is something quite different. These bodies are funded by the industries in a process sometimes referred to as self-regulation, but as I think is quite different, because it is self-regulation that consists of one firm codifying its own practice. It's not, sorry, self-regulation that is one firm codifying its own practice. Here we have standards that control the industries on a global scale. The book is therefore of vital importance in offering a strong contribution to the young but growing literature on the role of private actors in setting standards, regulation, and what is recently being referred to as private lawmaking. But it is also telling, from my perspective at least, that a subsection entitled Private Rules and Public Interests appears only on page 220. Mm-hmm. The book ends on page 226. Thank you.
Thank you, Amir. Well, Frank, you have the last word on this.
Okay.
Well, the panel goes.
A lot has been said, and thank you for the invitation to join the panel. I think we all agree on the importance of the topic, of the importance of private rulemakers, and I think we probably all would agree they're going to be more important in future. So it is important to know who they are and how they operate and who are the important actors. The book frames these questions in terms of power, who has it, who are the winners and losers. And the claim of the book, which comes early on, is that we, the authors, provide not only a framework for the analysis of private regulation, but also detailed empirical answers to the above questions. In other words, who the winners are and who's important. And my comments really are about those two claims. Do they hold up? Do they really provide us with that empirical, that framework for analysis and the empirical evidence on who the winners and losers are? I would start with some premises. There are two premises which are important, I think, for the analysis. One is institutions matter. It's worth stating. I happen to agree with it, and maybe we all do, but it is a premise. The second premise is that these key questions about the actors are best approached through the lens of power. And they justify the power perspective by referring to the realist tradition in international relations theory. And I think it's also about trying to separate out the normative from the positive in the analysis. And my reservation about it really is the importance in my mind about the normative when we think about institutions, rulemaking institutions. And the key normative concept I would just finger, or one of them, is about appropriate form. And appropriate form as a norm does affect the shape of institutions, for example, their degrees of inclusiveness in particular, and the norm of country representation rather than other forms of representation. It affects the substance of rulemaking. For example, we've moved from treaty-based international rulemaking to what is essentially a two-step agreement on principles followed by agreements on implementation and a whole range of intermediate instruments in that process. And that norms of appropriate form are also important for procedural rules. For example, notice and comment is a procedural norm. Now, my point about appropriate form is that this actually does affect quite dramatically, I think, who wins, who loses, who has importance, who has access, and so on and so forth. And I don't think one can just sweep this normative aside. Now, is there an alternative to looking at the power lens? Well, the obvious alternative from a normative point of view is to think in terms of authority. Who has authority? Authority is power, justified power, as compared with power, meaning power of A over B. And that would introduce the normative in a more considered way. It might result in rather different answers. Who has power? Who has authority? Or why is it that some people are regarded as having authority and others aren't, even though they might have some power. So I think this power lens is something one would want to question. But my main points about the analysis, about where the approach is situated, the typology, which has been mentioned, a shift in the analysis from company database to a country perspective, and this their treatment of expertise. The situating the approach is about the theoretical foundations they refer to. And they refer to the varieties of capitalism literature on their complementarity thesis, and they refer to narrative history, and the contribution to narrative history to this general subject is about theorizing change as gradual change, as compared with the standard theories of change in political science about punctuated equilibrium, waves, and so on. The question is, just how strong is this theoretical base? My impression about varieties of capitalism literature is that it's really disappeared out of sight in the light of the crisis. The varieties of capitalism have been swamped by the commonalities. The theory of gradual change, just how relevant is it to this? The adoption of the IFRS, International Reporting Standards, looks to me much more like a wave than a process of gradual change. But much more important, I think, is that post the crisis, the attention of theorists has been very much on non-linear models of change and change as complex change. So I would regard both these theoretical foundations as actually probably rather weak. And if one thinks that's important, then one might start thinking about what are alternative theoretical foundations for approaching this subject. On the typology, which has been mentioned by a couple of others, there's a key distinction they make between public non-market and private non-market. And their definition of private non-market is a private setting and governments not directly involved. Now, directly is a total weasel word in this context, because there are two issues here. There's a shadow of hierarchy, a literature they don't refer to, which really means that if private sector acts because otherwise the government will act. Government is the government or authorities' threat to act. And the other issue here is a principal agent issue. Who is using whom in this process? And when one looks at, say, the IASB, one cannot rule out the shadow of the hierarchy, the fact that there are official actors standing there in the background, whether it's G20, the Financial Stability Board, IOSCO, or the BIS, they are there with a very acute interest in what's happening on accounting standards and also on specific points of principle, not just the general approach to principles. And the private sector knows that very well. And of course, governments are critical for implementation. Whatever FASB agrees, they depend on the SEC. Whatever is agreed in the UK depends on, I suppose, the Financial Conduct Authority these days. So the officials are there. And to me, the key issue is that relationship between the private and the public, yep, when one's looking at power and influence and authority. And it's the variety of those principal-agent relationships which interests me and which I think should be the focus. We have, on the one hand, the Financial Action Task Force, where the private sector is dragged in really as agents of the governments. They are the ones who provide the data for whether terrorist financing or money laundering is taking place. The private sector is acting as an agent. With the case of the IASB, you could say that it's the governments who are acting as agents of the private rulemakers because they are the enforcers. But as I was saying, it's not as simple as that. You have a kind of shared principal role, and then, of course, you have a mutual dependency on implementation. And it's that interrelationship which I think one really has to tease out if one's going to look at the significance of the private rulemakers. On the analysis, my third point, the database they rely on is a company database, but they convert this into a country story and an EU-US story. They say, do companies represent the domestic? This appears on page 12. Well, this is the shift from a company database to a country data, country perspective. And this, to me, conflates two quite separate questions. The first question, and to me the prior question, is which company interests prevail in all this? How are they reflected? Then there's a translation question. If those are the company interests, how do they get reflected at the country level? So if you look at the IASB, the key features of the IFRS, as I understand it, is orientation towards decision-taking by investors in companies who depend on capital markets. In other words, it's an investor orientation. Now, which companies are interested in this? Who has pushed it? It presumably is companies that raise money on foreign markets as well as domestic. That would be one group you might want to look at. It could be that it's companies who appear in the key investor indices, Dow, DAX, FTSE. That would be another shot one would want to look at. Maybe it's where do the companies that represent the investors, where do they figure in the analysis? Pension funds, insurance funds. One would want to know how they figure in this standard setting. Well, what about the top five accounting firms? How do they fit into the formation of these international financial rules? Are they the ones who are really calling the shots? So there's a whole lot of company interest one would want to know about before one gets into the country thing. And the country thing may not be very irrelevant. Who wants Italy or France setting international financial reporting standards? Therefore, it doesn't really matter if they don't figure very far, and maybe their discomfort with the adoption of IFRS is purely because their own accounting standards have been domestic-oriented. So there's, not exactly a misuse of the database, but the database is not getting at the kinds of questions we actually want to know. The final point I'd like to make is about expertise and professionalism. Now, this is kept out of the analysis, and it's kept out of the analysis on two grounds. First of all, that experts disagree, and secondly, by reference to global cultural theory and rationalism. I just don't think it can be left out on basically what are two straw men. Professionalism permeates international rulemaking, whether it's the official bodies or public bodies or private bodies. It's a major reason why we turn to specialized bodies such as IASB and ISA. It gives us insight into who is important in rulemaking. It's relevant to questions of trust. Why don't we trust the EU with accounting standards? Well, it's for the reason I mentioned. We don't trust some of their members.
Yep.
It's important into what is adopted and when it's adopted and why it's adopted. And it's important for giving us insight into failures. The accounting industry is an example of failure. How many accounting firms blew the whistle on insolvent financial institutions? None of them, as far as I know. And there's a whole lot of relevant literature. Abbott on professions, the literature on epistemic elites, the diffusion of innovations, the sociological literature on that, on organizational failure and so on. How can this be excluded from the analysis? In my view, it simply can't be. So my conclusion is that the book claimed to give us a framework for the analysis and empirical answers to who is important. To my mind, it fails on both of those.